Tonight we are in Genesis chapter 8, verse 20 and 22. Noah's just gotten off the ark. And then we're going to move into chapter 9, where God is going to be speaking to Noah. He's actually going to say three things to him. In fact, if you turn to page 2, we can kind of do an introduction here. On the bottom of page 2, when we get into chapter 9, chapter 9 can be divided into two parts. Or at least what we're looking at tonight is first chapter 9, verses 1 through 7. Is what man must do. This is what God is telling man's responsibility now that they're getting off the ark. Noah's going to be a type of second Adam. We're going to have a second start, a new beginning. There's going to be some new ground rules laid down, and man will be told that this is what he expects. And then between chapter or verse 8 and 17, it's going to be amazing what God is going to do. And he's going to speak three different conversations he's going to have. But this is the things that God is saying you can expect from me in this new age. So there's going to be some things in this new age that man is to do, and some new things that God is going to do. And right above on page 2, where it says 9, verse 1 through 7 and 9, 8 through 17, you'll notice, and I'll address these as we go by. Some of them I can explain. Some of them are just kind of like, well, there it is. What does that mean? But several things seem to have changed due to the flood that are referred to in these verses. If it's because of the atmospheric change, if it's because God has changed some principles, if it's because something has transpired between before the flood and after the flood, these are things that you're going to see mentioned that we don't necessarily see before the flood. A, it's seasons. They're going to mention seasons. Now, whatever takes place, were there seasons before the flood? There was seeds, there was a harvest, there was fruit, but were there seasons? It seems possibly seasons have now been established because of some kind of a change. You want to talk about climate change? This is where climate change occurred. I mean, pretty sure between chapter 6 and chapter 9, there has been a climate change in the earth. And how that looks is definitely not out of control. It's under God's control, and it's definitely not because of automobiles. But nonetheless, there are seasons, and that's part of a new rotation, possibly. Also, animal behavior is going to change. We're talking about it going to have the fear of man is going to be on the animals. Now, is that something God caused? Is it because what? One of the things we've mentioned before is it's possible of the atmospheric pressure and it was more oxygen or easier to breathe and man received more oxygen that it just created a richer bloodstream, a longer life, because right after the flood, lifespans begin to cut in half. And then after the fall of Babel, they cut in half again until finally they taper down to David's time where it's about 70 years. There's going to be a fluctuation somewhat, but nothing like centuries old. And you can say that's a legend, or you can say there's some changes taking place. One, animal behavior, or two, animal behavior. Another one is the human judicial system will be established here. It appears maybe part of the wickedness of man in chapter 6 was because no one was in charge. No one was held accountable. They just sinned and just kept sinning. And now God is going to say, no, man, you need to have some kind of a system, and we'll look at that. Human judicial system will be ordained by God. We look back when Cain killed Abel, there was no real punishment. It's more like a conversation between him and God. When Lamech was injured, Lamech killed a man and says, my vengeance will be 70 times 7. And so it's almost like a vigilante. Well, that was a little over extreme and maybe led to all the wickedness. There may have been a judicial system, but it may have been more of a my own opinion. This is my truth. This is what I think is justice. I was injured, so I'm going to kill these people over here. It's like, okay, there's going to be more of an accountability. Man is going to be set into a standard. But anyway, human judicial system is going to develop. Human diet seems to have changed. God is going to make it very clear. As I gave you all the plants, I now give you the animals to eat. Now, does that mean, it's not said blatantly, but it's implicit, if not explicit. It's definitely implicit. Man wasn't eating the animals before the flood. And again, I can't make that a doctrinal statement, but we do have a definite statement. As I gave you the plants, I now give you the animals to eat. So human diet is going to change. Letter E, the rainbow or light reflection, the atmosphere, there's going to appear a rainbow. Now, is there a rainbow that they didn't appear before the flood? Some have argued or tried to present that case because of the atmosphere, possibly because of the canopy of water over the atmosphere protecting the earth, you know, keeping out ultraviolet rays or different things. With the removal of that and whatever caused the flood, the waters that from above came down, we now have the possibility of light reflection from an atmosphere that has changed. Now, again, I'm not going to say there were no rainbows before, but it does seem to be an outstanding thing that God is going to say, I'm going to put a rainbow in the sky. It's like, well, it's been there since we've always seen a rainbow. Maybe it's always been there. Maybe he's going to make a special purpose for it now or a meaning to it now. I can't say there were no seasons. I can't say the animals used to talk to man. I can't say that there was no justice in the earth before. I can't say that humans didn't eat animals before. And I can't say there was no rainbows in the sky before. But I can say God is making a big deal that now there's going to be seasons. Now the animals' behavior is going to change. They're going to be afraid of you. The human judicial system is established. The human diet is going to be given animals to eat, and he's going to make a big deal about the rainbow. It also is going to, as we close it down, there's no possibility of flooding the earth again. Flooding the earth is no longer an option. Basically, it's no longer an option because God says, I will not do it again. So that's good enough. God says, I will not flood the earth again. Case solved. He's not going to do it. But if we want to back up, why is he not going to do it again? Because I don't want to say God can't do it again, because he certainly can do whatever he wants to, but the system that he broke down to cause the universal flood, that system's gone. It's not. I can't just have the waters above the earth and all waters in the earth flood the whole earth without mountains. So now there's mountains. The waters above have already gone down. They've already been absorbed. Whatever. God is not going to do it again. Now I'm saying potentially, why is he not going to do it again? Because he can't do it again, because that system is no longer available to flood the earth. Do you understand what I'm saying? God is not going to flood the earth again. That's part of the promise. That's the covenant. But just like, we say animal behavior has changed. All the animals were talking and having, eating plants with the humans. So I can't say that. But something changed. They're running away from humans now. And then the last one is God makes a covenant. It's a new covenant with Noah, which means, again, it's a new beginning. This is a covenant he did not have before. And it's, in a sense, the first mention of covenant in Genesis. A lot of times I will say, the writers I read, the commentators, they'll talk about a covenant that he had with Adam, that there was some kind of a covenant that they had. It appears there's some dialogue going on, but he doesn't use the word covenant with Adam. So here it becomes a covenant here in these verses tonight. So with that being said, I'm going to go ahead and read just straight through the text, and you can listen for some of those things. I'll read through these verses. I'll try to read through them in the NIV without comment, or at least too many comments. I ask Tony after class all the time. I mean, it's one of those things where, your spouse asks you a question, it's like, here it comes. It's like every time, and I go, well, what'd you think of class? And she's not here, and I don't want to talk, bad about her. I'm not saying anything bad about her. But it's like, it's just, she knows that as we're putting the equipment away or when we get in the car, when she's not here tonight, we drive off, and I'll ask her, what'd you think of class? And so she's when she's listening on Sundays or Monday, she's listening for what am I going to say? Because she knows the questions come. I'm not going to say, what did you learn? Or trying to see if you were paying attention. But it's like, how did I do? Did I communicate? And one of the things she says recently, and she said before, it's like, she says, one thing she says, you know, it's okay, but you do repeat yourself a lot. And that would be, you know, not a criticism, it's just an observation. You know, I could reduce this from an hour to like 20 minutes. And so what I'm saying, the reason I'm saying that is I'm going to read this to you. And then teach it all to you. Then I'll say, okay, now let's look at the notes. I'm going to read it to you in the English Standard Version and teach it all to you again. And I've already told you the things that have already changed. I can say, well, that's pretty much what's there, and we could go home right now. But you've got to hear it two more times tonight before we're done. And so I respect her opinion. I do tend to repeat myself. So here it is. I'm going to repeat myself now for the second time. But this time I'm going to add the verses. Here we go. Chapter 8 of Genesis. Again, we've just gotten off the ark. We went through all the 40 days, the 110 days, the 370 days. And in verse 20, then Noah built an altar to the Lord, and taking some of all the clean animals and clean birds, he sacrificed burnt offerings on it. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, and that's an important phrase, pleasing, and said in his heart, never again will I curse the ground. Curse is a different word than the curse used in earlier in Genesis. Never again will I curse the ground because of man, even though every inclination of his heart is evil from childhood. He still has a sin nature, but I'm not going to deal with it like that again. Not that he couldn't, but I'm promising you, I'm not going to do that again. And never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. Now again, this is not taken out of the fact that Jesus is going to come back in judgment at the second coming. And Peter even refers to it, that was first God destroyed it with water, the next is going to be with fire. So again, this is by no means saying there's no judgment coming, because judgment is coming, it's just not going to be like this. Chapter 8, verse 22, as long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. Now, we've had day and night from the very beginning. I mean, you can't argue with that. There's day and night in the beginning. But is there a room to say there wasn't cold and heat like we know today? For example, I just was talking to someone that had just come back from vacation down near the equator. I can't think of where they were at. I never get out of Iowa. But they're down somewhere by the equator. And, you know, we ask about, well, what's the climate like? It's like, well, it never really varies. You it's so consistent because it's always the same. So in that case, there's no, what we have, like in Iowa, we have four definite seasons. So on the equator, for example, there's no change. There's no seasons. And speaking without experience, could that have been the way it was in the original earth with that perfect canopy of water? If there was a canopy of water, was there more of a, and even they go back and they look at the fossil records, it appears that things were very tropical. Plants were larger, animals were larger. Again, that's looking at the fossil record. So was it more conducive for, and because of what took place, is this an addition? Obviously, day and night are not an addition, but are these other things an addition? I can't say that, but it's interesting that God brings this up. Why is he saying these things are going to be consistent? Well, one, he just got done rocking the earth and changed, and there was no consistency. I mean, they went through a whole year, and I'm not sure if they had winter and summer and planting and harvest during the last year. They certainly weren't planting anything. Is he just reestablishing it? Now, see, I'm teaching. I'm going to come back and say all this again. Chapter 9, verse 1. Then God, now here again, these are the first 1 through 7. This is Noah's expectation. Then God blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. The fear and dread of you will fall upon all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air, upon every creature that moves along the ground, and upon all the fish of the sea. Which seems to indicate it's like before that, it was like a Disney movie. You know, all the animals just walking and talking. Okay. They are given into your hands. Everything that lives and moves will be food for you. Just as I gave you the green plants, I now give you everything. Sure seems like it sounds like a change. But you must not eat meat. Now here's a regulation. You must not eat meat with its lifeblood still in it. And for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. Meaning if a man gets killed or eaten, that he's not promoting that, but if a man's blood is shed, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal. See, now, is this new? Animals could possibly kill a man. Did that happen before? I don't know. But he's going to say, now if an animal kills a man, I will demand an accounting from that animal for killing a man. And from each man, too. Even if a man kills an animal, or a man kills a man, I'll demand an accounting. I'll demand an accounting for the life of his fellow man. And verse 6 puts it in a form. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. Who's going to hold this accountability? Well, mankind is going to have to. So we don't go back to Genesis 6 where there's chaos, total evil in the earth. Guys like Lamech, I'll kill, 70 times my vengeance. I'll unleash if someone hurts me. But now it's like that vengeance is not going to be personal. It's going to be some kind of apparently judicial system that man is going to have to establish. Man is going to be, again, this is, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, but man is going to be held accountable. And would it not be interesting if man says, I don't want to be that accountable. We're not going to let men be punished for killing someone. We're going to just overlook it. God's making a command. One of the expectations is, if man sheds man's blood, by man will his blood be shed. Now, if you're following God, you don't have a choice. Your only option is to figure out a judicial system to make sure it's fair and judicial and just. But you can't say, yeah, I know he killed him, but, we'll just let it go. Even an animal kills a man. We got to find the animal and take care of it. Well, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. Why? Why is this important to God? Because, for in the image of God has God made man. In other words, God is saying, I take it as a personal attack, a personal insult, an affront. If you kill a man, that's my image. That is what I made to represent myself, and you're killing him. You can't get away with that. It's not just you killed a man. You killed someone that's made in the image of God. Wow. I'll say this. Tony was telling me about a video she saw of what do you call those ultrasounds of the pregnant lady, and they used to be just this beep 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 kind of like a space thing in the 60s, and now they're like almost like a video. I haven't really seen them, but she was telling me. She says you can see the face of the baby in the womb. And she was, in this particular case, whenever the father would come in the room and talk, the baby would smile. And then when he would stop, they would stop smiling. And then when the voice came back, they would smile at the sound of their father's voice in the womb. That's not in the text of Scripture, but it is stunning when you read, for in the image of God has God made man, and then is there life in the womb? It's like, how stupid is our culture? I mean, how much, we are not a third world country. America is not a third world country physically. But we are thinking, I don't even know what a third world country thinks like. But we are thinking at a third, maybe fourth or fifth world level of just stupid logic. Poor philosophy. It's like, it's just a matter of time before that third world thinking manifests in a third world reality that we live in. And it's scary because I'm 64, but Tyler's 12. And I'm going to be here for, you know, how many more years? I'm afraid I'm going to see some things I don't want to see. But Tyler's going to be here for 6-7 more decades. Nonetheless, we don't need third world thinking. Anyway, that's not what this verse is saying. It's just saying, for in the image of God has God made man. As for you, Noah, your purpose, be fruitful and increase in number, multiply on the earth and increase upon it. I want you to fill this earth again. And that is what he's talking to man. Now he switches to himself. This is what God is going to do in this new creation after the flood. Then God said to Noah, and I was going to say three times he's going to speak and have a speech. You can kind of find them here and underline. I've got them kind of underlined in the notes. But here's the first one. Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, I now establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you and with every living creature that was with you, the birds, the livestock, and all the wild animals and all those that came out of the ark with you, every living creature on earth, I establish my covenant with you. Now that is a treaty between God and another party. And here's the covenant. What is that covenant? Never again will all life be cut off by the waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. That's the covenant. I will not do this again. I'm not going to flood the earth again. Now, why is that important? Well, because if I'm a guy getting off the ark and I just saw millions of people, you know, bobbing up and down and floating to their death, and, you know, that could happen again. I might just build something tall. I might build something big. I may build a flood shelter, just like you buy a nuclear bunker or whatever. I may make sure that God said, no. I don't need everybody running around in all their different new cultures that we're going to have building tall buildings or tall, like, pyramid-like shaped structures to try and get away from the waters when they come. And guess what men did? Look around. One of the things they say, it's interesting, all cultures have something very similar to the ziggurat or the pyramids in every culture. Why? Because everybody ran to they were dispersed from the Tower of Babel with what memory? Oh, the flood. You know what we need to do? I know what we need to do. We need to build a structure, a temple, very high. And again, I'm not sure if that's a connection. I don't have a biblical connection to that. But this is what God is saying. I will never do it again. So if you trust God, don't need to worry about there's going to be judgment, but you don't need to worry about being flooded in a universal flood again. Verse 12, and God says, this is the sign of the covenant. Now, he just told you the covenant. Now he says, this is the sign of the covenant. I am making between me and you and every living creature with you a covenant for all generations to come. I mean, it's endless. I have set my rainbow in the clouds. We'll look at that word when we get to it. Rainbow, it's the word bow. It's the same word for the word bow that's used for hunting or military. He is hanging his military bow in the sky. And that means it doesn't mean rainbow, like, you know, it means bow. And again, we interpret that because God didn't hang like a physical bow somewhere. It's like, well, that's the rainbow. I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Now watch. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and the rainbow appears in the clouds, guess what? Then you can remember that I'm not going to flood the earth again. No, that's not what it says. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth, again, I'm teaching, clouds could be referring to, you know, just clouds, storms coming in, or it could refer to a theophany, you know, where the clouds of God's presence roll in, or more likely, there's going to be storms that can be part of God's anger, God's judgment, because there will be storms in life. But whenever a cloud, a storm blows in, it will be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will remember my covenant between me and you and all living creatures of every kind. I'm starting to roll in with some kind of judgment. It's like, whoa, there's that rainbow. Yep, I will remember, it'll be brought to my mind, I will not cross any further than that. I will not wipe out all mankind. I mean, you understand, if we get a perspective of what sin is and how wretched humanity is, I mean, we could do that individually, how God's wrath is being poured out. But he says, I'm making a covenant with you to keep me in check. Not that God's out of control, but I'm going to draw a line right here. I will become angry. I want to pour out my wrath. But whoa, whoa, whoa. Wait. I promise I will not cross this line again. And when I come out in judgment, when the clouds roll in, I'll remember I'm not going any further. Just beware. But that doesn't mean judgment isn't going to come. You can read throughout the Old Testament, Old Testament, but it's never a universal judgment. And interesting, the rainbow is put in the sky. We can see it, but it's put in the sky for whose purpose? God is saying it's for him. I will remember my covenant between me and you and all the living creatures of every kind. Never again will the waters become a flood to destroy all life. He's not saying it won't flood. He's saying it won't flood to destroy all life. That means animals, people. Whenever the rainbow appears in the clouds, look, I will see it. He doesn't say you will see it. He says, I will see it and remember. He says it a second time. The everlasting covenant between God and all living creatures of every kind on earth. So God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant I have established between me and all of life on the earth. I promise this will never happen again. I'm putting my bow in the sky, so when I roll in judgment, I'll see that bow and I'll remember this is all the further I'm going to go. And then I'll back off. And that's the end of the story of Noah. What we have now is now the sons of Noah, beginning verse 18. Now we move on into the next generations and the genealogies. But that is what we're looking at right there in those verses. So, with that being said, that's the second time through tonight's notes. Now we're going to look at the actual notes and see the verses in the English Standard. These are now in the English Standard with the Hebrew beside it. Again, Noah's just gotten off the ark. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took some of every clean animal and some of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. So he gets off the ark. The first thing he does as they get off is he builds an altar to the Lord. The altar to the Lord is probably for thanksgiving. Thank you for preserving us. And probably is for atonement of reestablishing a relationship with God. And their offering, it's going to be whole burnt offerings. Whole animals are going to be burnt on this altar. And again, every clean animal, if you remember when they're putting animals on the ark, some were called clean animals. Instead of putting two, they put seven. Seven pairs went on, so there would be extra animals for this sacrifice. It's going to include clean animals and clean birds are going to be offered as a burnt offering. Interesting, animals have been sacrificed from the beginning when Adam had clothes made out of the skin of animals for himself by God. That would be some kind of an animal died. Was it a sacrifice? It could have been. But all the way through, animals have been sacrificed, but they've never been potentially eaten. Now they're going to be eaten also. And the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma. I've got in the box in the Hebrew there, the word pleasing. If you look there in the Hebrew transliteration or the Hebrew text, the word pleasing can also be soothing. A soothing aroma. God smelt a soothing aroma, and that word is nikhoah. Nikhoah, which is a word that comes from and is similar to or from the same root as the word Noah. Remember, Noah will comfort us in the labor of our toil. Here now the word is same root word Noah. It means pleasing, and the word speaks, could be translated, soothing. And it speaks of rest and tranquility. So God, now watch how this works. God, he just flooded the earth. He was upset with the evil. And now Noah gets off. First, he gets off the ark. He offers a sacrifice. And God is now soothed. God is now resting. God is now at peace because of the pleasing, it's translated English Standard, pleasing aroma of the sacrifices, which is just interesting. He's pleased. He's pleased with Noah's thankfulness. He's pleased with the atonement, but he's also pleased with his creation and the chance to, let's try this again. He's not given up. That's the good news. From the beginning, when he says that the seed of the woman is going to crush the serpent's head, that's for man's benefit, but that's also God's plan to destroy evil. And so when man, who is the instrument that God is going to use to destroy evil, rebels against God and joins evil, it's frustrating. The seed of the woman is going to crush the serpent's head. The seed of the woman is going to destroy evil. Ultimately, you know, it's going to destroy death. See, Jesus will destroy death. But on the way of getting to the Messiah, the seed of the woman that's going to do this, God has to endure mankind getting through all these phases, that however he's working the plan of salvation, and he sees this this offering, he smells the aroma, it's pleasing, it's soothing, it's comforting to him, knowing, okay, now we're going to try again. Noah's on the right page, here we go, and he's ready to re-engage it. Smelt the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, says in his heart now, it's going to turn into a covenant later on in chapter 9, but right now in chapter 8, verse 21, he says, I will never again curse the ground. And that word curse is not, like I said, not the same word back in Genesis 3:17, where because of Adam's sin, cursed is the ground. It's going to produce thistles and weeds. It is a word that it means more like dishonor. Never again will I dishonor the ground with a flood, like just destroy it from what its whole purpose is, because of man. I'll never dishonor the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Man's nature hasn't changed. So he sees Noah get off the ark. He's thankful. Offering of atonement. God is pleased with this new opportunity. The aroma is soothing to him, but he says, I know things have not changed. Every just like it was before the flood in Genesis chapter 6, every inclination of their heart was evil all the time. He says, I know I'm still dealing with humanity who's got this evil tendency, but it's through them I'm going to bring about the Messiah that's going to crush the serpent's head and deliver man from that evil nature. Neither will I again strike down every living creature as I have done. Okay, now a couple things in the notes there. I find it interesting right here. I pointed out before, the flood tablet right here comes from the Gilgamesh tablet, the Gilgamesh account, the Epic of Gilgamesh. He's a king listed deep into the Sumerian king list, so he appears to be a legitimate king, Gilgamesh. But there's legends written about him and what he goes through, and he goes off and visits this Noah character. We'll talk about it here in a moment. In fact, I'm going to mention it right here. In the Gilgamesh Epic, it records the flood. In fact, this is tablet right here is from the Gilgamesh Epic in cuneiform writing, recording the flood that came. Also, the king's tablet, Sumerian king list, it also listens the kings before the flood and the kings after the flood, mentioning the flood came and wiped everything out. And then after the flood, kingship was reestablished by God from heaven. So the flood is mentioned here and here. In this Gilgamesh tablet right here, just interesting, just a connection. This is just part of Mesopotamian culture. The Gilgamesh epic remembers the gods when the Noah got off the ark, and his name is right there, Unapushtim. And you can see it's Unapishtim. Unapushtim is his name here. And eventually Gilgamesh is going to travel a great distance, cross seas, go through the big thick forest, and find this Unapushtim, because he's attained eternal life from the gods. And he's going to ask him how he can attain eternal life. That's part of the Gilgamesh tablet. In other words, Gilgamesh is going to travel to meet this ancient man who is from the days before the flood, which we would call Noah. Nonetheless, in this account, the Gilgamesh tablet, when Yunupushtim got off the ark, which is the Noah character. The gods are said to have gathered around the sacrifice that he offered when he got off the boat. They gathered around like flies because they were dependent on mankind to provide for them food for the gods. So what happens is the gods got mad in the story of the Gilgamesh epic. The gods got mad because man was so noisy, disturbing the gods. So they says, let's just kill them all. And they says, yeah, that's a great idea. But one god goes, oh no, and went down and told Yunupushtim, or another individual in another account, another legend has a different name. And then he built a boat, saved the animals. But while man was gone, there were no sacrifices. So the gods are like, hey, we forgot. Who's going to feed us? Who's going to give us offerings? Because the gods' survival was based on eating the food sacrificed on an idol or on an altar. Notice it's similar to the biblical account, but God is so far above and beyond these gods. But you see how mankind is trying to dumb down God and put him in their understanding and have multiple of them. Nonetheless, they gather around like flies. It says it repeatedly. They gathered around like flies because they loved the smell and were eager to eat the food. Turn the page. I've got a little box there about the Epic of Gilgamesh right there. I'll say it one more time. Epic of Gilgamesh is ultimately contained in 12 large tablets. The original was found in, not the original, but this one was found from written in 650 B.C., but they are obviously not the original because they found fragments of this flood story in the Epic of Gilgamesh going way back to 2000 B.C. They assume that these writings go back as far as 3,300 B.C., which would put them right up in here. You see this right in here? That puts us right around our dating right here, that this story is that ancient. That's secular science, secular linguists saying it goes back to the dates that we've got here for the flood account. And it's been copied and copied and copied. And finally, what they found here, and they found older ones also, is a one from 650 B.C. Okay. One more point on that verse is interesting to see Noah was his own priest. There's no Levitical priesthood. Cain and Abel offer their sacrifices. Here, Noah offers his sacrifice. Abraham's going to offer sacrifices. Jacob's going to offer sacrifices. In fact, Job is offering sacrifices, which I think he's alive at the same time as Abraham was. It wasn't until the Mosaic Code is written that now you've got a separate priesthood that's going to be responsible for the sacrificial systems because they've got to follow the code. If every man, as they are here, is allowed to make their own sacrifices, you can see how things would deviate and become, this is my way of doing it, this is my way. They've got their own little rituals and bring in their own meanings, and they could actually have a very corrupt religious system. In fact, you could have a multiple gods, as the Mesopotamians did. When Moses comes out of Egypt, he's going to give them a rigid, strict list to follow, rituals to follow. And part of that is, so you do not, it is like Paul, Peter says, the scriptures are not for your private interpretation. You do not get to just go and recreate God in your own image by using different verses of the Bible. This Bible has to be interpreted in line with the way it's written. It has to be interpreted exegetically. It's not open to private interpretation. Before the Mosaic Law, all the sacrifices could be your own personal, how do you feel about offering things to God? And that obviously deteriorates into paganism. So at this point, Noah is his own priest. Chapter 8, verse 22, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will not cease. And that closes down chapter 8 as God is now establishing the earth in its pattern. This is going to go on and on year after year after year. There's going to be seasons. We are not going to, and you can't, it never has happened, we are not going to interrupt the solar system, the season system. We're going to just keep this thing rotating all the way through, not until we get to Revelation, where you get to the wrath of God, do things start happening where a third of the light is gone, a third of the day is dark, a third of the moon is gone. You're going to have things like the stars are disappearing. You're going to have earthquakes that have never been happened before. Things are going to just, it's like God is rocking the earth. It talks about the earth. The Old Testament prophets talk about the day when the earth begins to wobble. It's just out of sync. Something's wrong. And that's the difference. From the flood until the day of the second coming, the day of the Lord, there's going to be this steady, and this guarantees it, we're going to have a steady progression up until this point. God says, I put a rainbow, I'm not going to do that again, but he's going to promise there's a day coming where the earth is going to rock again. There's going to be earthquakes, there's going to be stars falling out of the sky, there's going to be major disasters. And now we're into eschatology. But that's for another day. Now, page 3, chapter 9, verse 1. We're going to now talk about what these commands that God gave Noah, make some comments about that. In the English Standard Version, chapter 9, verse 1, and God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. That is the purpose. Man's purpose is to multiply and fill the earth. Get out and enjoy creation. Use creation. It's for man to fill. God made the earth and put man in it, and his intention is man to spread out over the earth and use all the aspects of the earth. Now again, that's kind of important because that explains the problem with the Tower of Babel. Man is going to intentionally not do this. Let's not spread out and become weak. Let's stay together and let's build a tower that reaches the heavens. Great idea. We don't want to get flooded again. We'll have a place to run. And let's not spread out. Let's all stay together so this doesn't weaken us. They try to group together. And so in a sense, the Tower of Babel, it doesn't necessarily say that explicitly, except the two things. God says, I'm not going to flood the earth again. Don't worry about it. And spread out. Fill the earth. Turn to the Tower of Babel. We're not going to spread out. In fact, we better prepare for another flood. Chapter 9, verse 2. The fear of you, he tells Noah and his sons and the wives, and the dread of you, and that is plural, shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the air. Now, again, that can't be something that has always been. There's got to have been some kind of this lack of fear. But God is now going to cause a fear to come on the animals. It may explain why the animals came and got on the ark. Noah builds the ark and the animals came. I don't have any insight. I don't have any insight into this, except people ask, how did all the animals just come get on the ark? Well, one, it says here, now the fear of the animals. Did God take the fear of the animals away so they would get on the ark and follow Noah? Or was there never a fear of the animals like we have today? Now, again, not all animals are fearful, like dogs. Isn't it interesting that different species have a different level of tolerance for man's presence? And some animals can be trained, some dogs. I mean, that's why dogs are so, they're personable. I mean, dogs are man's best friend. I don't have a dog, but sometimes I see people with dogs, and I wish I had a friend like that. Man, I don't have anybody like that dog. So there's different levels of this dread, but nonetheless, God is making a point. The dread of the animals shall fall, or the beast shall fall upon the birds and the animals, and everything that creeps on the ground, and all the fish of the sea, into your hands they are delivered. Now, they are delivered. Look at point 3. This is very similar to the beginning of Genesis, where man is given dominion over every creature on the earth. Here, they also have dominion over them, but something's changed. The animals are afraid of man, let me read it. Point 3, this verse is close to chapter 1, verse 28 through 30, but includes two changes. Having dominion over the living creatures is replaced with the promise that the creatures will fear and dread human beings. So it would be interesting to think man had dominion over the animals, but the animals had no fear of man. It would be like a Disney movie, potentially. Not promoting Disney by any means. But now there's going to be this fear. And B, previous people were to eat plants. Humans are now given permission to eat animals. And so two things are changing right here. Point one on there in the Gilgamesh epic, once again, the wild man, this friend of his that he finds, he's a wild man that seeks out the king to challenge him. His name is Enkidu, who sought out King Gilgamesh and became his friend before, when he was a wild man. This is not Bible. This is not Jewish tradition. This is the epic of Gilgamesh. But Enkidu was previously a wild man who lived away from civilization, and he just ate plants with the animals, and the animals and him were friends. They communicated. But when Enkidu wanted to pursue Gilgamesh and challenge him, he went into the city. He became civilized, ultimately becomes the best friend of Gilgamesh. But once that happens, the animals were afraid of him. And that's in this story of Gilgamesh. No point except, you know, now I'm telling you legends of the Mesopotamians. Just a very similar thing. And that's point one. Meat in the ancient world was a delicacy, so it's possible they didn't eat meat just because it was rare. It definitely is going to be rare in this culture, and it wasn't used except for special occasions throughout history and for religious ceremonies. You can even see that in the Jewish feast. Chapter 9, verse 3. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you, and as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. And we've mentioned that before. Now they're going to begin eating animals. But you shall not eat the flesh with its life, that is, its blood. One rule for man, again, we're still in verses 1 through 7, the rules for man, is if you can eat animals, but you can't eat the blood. The blood has to be drained out of them. Now, point one, why is that a rule? I don't know for sure. One, it could be just honoring the life of the animal. Or two, it would guarantee the animal wasn't still alive while you're eating it. You can't just start chewing on an animal. But the blood is forbidden to be something that they would eat. Draining the blood was practiced in the Levitical law, but no practice like that has been found in this. I mean, there's no practice in here where they insist or they practice draining the blood in any kind of writings. We do have this story from 1 Samuel chapter 14. Maybe you find it interesting. But remember, the Philistines were an unclean people. They were Greeks that had came over and settled on the coast of Philistia, Gaza Strip today. And Jonathan and King Saul, David, had to deal with the Philistines, as you know. Much we can say about the Philistines. But on this particular day in 1 Samuel 14, Saul and his son Jonathan and his men had defeated the Philistines and plundered them. And according to the law of Moses, and according to the law of Noah that we're getting right here, you can't eat animals with blood in them. You've got to drain the blood. So here we go. Now again, that was for Noah and the Levitical law. The pagans never necessarily followed that. They just kept on. Well, here it is. They struck down the Philistines. This is 1 Samuel 14:31. They struck down Israel, struck down the Philistines that day from Michmash to Aijalon. And the people were very faint, tired, worn out. The people pounced on the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slaughtered them on the ground. And the people ate them with the blood. Then they told Saul, "Behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating the blood." And he says, "You have dealt treacherously. Roll a great stone to me here." So he got a big stone, rolled a big stone up there by him. And Saul said, "Disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, let every man bring his ox or his sheep and slaughter them here on this stone and eat, and do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood." So every one of the people brought his ox with him that night, and they slaughtered them there. And Saul built an altar to the Lord, and it was the first altar that he had built to the Lord. So right there, there's an example of when they plundered the Gentiles. I mean, every man brought his ox. They got, it looks like they're eating everything. I mean, it's like, talk about a barbecue. They got all these sheep and all these oxen, and they're bringing up, and they're finally started slaughtering correctly, and they ate all night long. What a party. But nonetheless, that's dealing with the blood. It was wrong to eat the blood. But yet, they weren't even thinking about. They just were acting like the Philistines, acting like pagans. Chapter 9, verse 5. And for your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. Now, this is now man's blood. For every beast, I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. And again, I've written that all down, several things I said before. But right there, it's pretty clear that if a man's blood is shed, someone's going to have to take account for it. There's going to be some kind of a judicial system that oversees that. Up until this time, it's possible there was no government like we would know it or legal system like we would know it, which would explain why things got so wicked before. Now, we'd say, well, that makes common sense. But remember, the world was different back in those days. There's just certain things that, not that they weren't smart enough, because I think they're brilliant. There was just ways they weren't doing things. And so this was now a new thing that God established, maybe to prevent a reoccurring of Genesis 6, of just the chaotic, lawless society. You know, borderless nations and free money and people don't have to work. Well, like a third world country. And so point 5 on page 5, since man was the image of God, or an attack on man is seen as an attack on God. Innocent man is not to be harmed, but guilty men must be condemned and punished. And the point is, man sheds blood, by man shall his blood be shed. That establishes a just system. You don't get killed for a speeding ticket, but you murder a man, you will have to pay for your life. Then all the way down, that's the greatest crime, and then we'd assume all the other crimes underneath that would have a crime and a matching penalty of equivalent. So it's establishing the judicial code. Now, what I have here is a picture, you know of this. It's the Hammurabi's code. It's the Hammurabi steel, made in 1770. This is when this comes about, and it's got all kinds of laws, very similar in many cases to the laws of Moses. It's got things like, well, you know, the crimes. It lists the crime and the penalty that you'd have to pay for the crime. It's a very advanced legal system that Hammurabi, who is a king, mentioned on the Sumerian king list, he's listed here, that he would have. This would be the judicial system that he's going out of his way to establish it. The image is right there. That's, you see the picture of a man on the throne and another man standing in front. That is not Hammurabi on the throne. Hammurabi is the man receiving the law, the code from the God sitting on the throne. So again, he is claiming to have received this from deity, that this is the way we're going to run our country here in Samaria. So then again, and then of course, to make myself look cool, I've got a picture of myself there with that. All right. But that may be that this law, this concept would have then affected all these cultures as they begin establishing laws. Chapter 9, verse 7, and you will be fruitful and multiply, increase greatly on the earth and multiply in it. Once again, you is plural, and that's God's purpose, man multiply. Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, behold, I establish my covenant. Now we get into the covenant that God's going to have. He's going to speak three times here. And basically what is going to be said right here, I'm making a covenant. I'm making a promise. I'm binding myself. And just like he bound himself to Abraham, like the Jews can rebel all they want to. They can kill the Messiah. They can desecrate the temple. They can have King Manasseh. They can put Jezebel there with Ahab. But God has made a covenant with Abraham. They will be my people. I will punish them, but I will never get rid of them. So the Jews have a covenant with Yahweh that he's going to be there, not based on them, but based on his promise. David will have a man on the throne based on God's promise to David. Not because David and all of his descendants are great, but because God says, David, I'm going to make sure your son sits on the throne forever. We'll judge Israel. We'll judge the world. I make that covenant. Well, what do I have to do it? Nothing. I bind myself to this covenant. He bound himself to the land covenant. He bound himself to the Abrahamic covenant. And he binds himself now to the Noahic covenant. I will. What does Noah have to do? This is not about Noah. This is God saying, I'm going to make a covenant with you. This is what we'd call an unconditional covenant. The Mosaic covenant, as you know, is a... This is interesting. You should listen to this. This will help you someday. The Abrahamic covenant is unconditional. God made a covenant with Abraham. He's going to make sure there's a people. The Palestinian covenant, or the land covenant, that God will give the land to Israel, is going to be Israel's land forever. The Davidic covenant, there'll be a son of David sitting on the throne, ruling Israel, ruling the world forever. That is the covenant. What do we have to do? Those are covenants. God will never flood the earth again unless we do what? He made a covenant. I will not do it. The storm clouds will roll out, but the rainbow will appear, and I'll remember, I can't go any further. Listen, the Mosaic covenant is not an unconditional covenant. The Mosaic covenant is a conditional covenant, meaning it is given, and if it is broken, God will punish them. The covenant itself can be set aside. Abrahamic covenant doesn't expire. Noah covenant doesn't expire. The Davidic covenant doesn't expire. The Mosaic covenant, that is a conditional covenant, that it is not based, that God is not going to say, I'm going to do this forever. At some point, it can end. In fact, when Jesus fulfilled it, when Jesus met all the requirements of it, in other words, the covenant was pointing towards Jesus, and once Jesus came, the purpose of the covenant was to point to Jesus, and once he's here, it's like, we don't need that anymore. Yeah, but it's a covenant. It was a temporary covenant. It came, and it doesn't change anything, which again explains, like we were talking about the other night, reading the Old Testament is pointing to Jesus, and if you can read the Old Testament and not find Jesus, and you're still obeying the Old Covenant, you've missed the whole purpose of it. You're in disobedience. You're still, in a sense, finding your own personal interpretation of the Scriptures. Let's hurry. Chapter 9, verse 8, Then God said to Noah and to his sons, Behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your offspring after you. 9:10. What else I got in there? I think everything I've said. Chapter 9, verse 10, And with every living creature. Notice it's not just with man, but with all the living creatures that is with you, the birds, the livestock, and every beast of the earth with you, as many as came out of the ark, it is for every beast of the earth. I will not destroy them again. And he says in verse 11, I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. Chapter 9, verse 12, And God said, here's the second time, this is the sign of the covenant. And I've got sign underlined. I can show you the, in fact, you can find it right there, ought. You can see it in the Hebrew right there. It's kind of right in the middle there. O-W-T is how it's transliterated. This is the ought of the covenant, and covenant is also it's a berit, the ought of the berit, that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. You can tell it's unconditional because what are the living creatures supposed to do to help keep the covenant? They just got to be a living creature. God is making this covenant for himself. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Now, where it says bow, I've got that in a square box in the Hebrew text, and I've got it underlined. It is the word kwesheth, and it means bow. It doesn't mean rainbow. It means bow. And it is used, the same word used in hunting and battle verses. It is the bow. I have hung my bow in the heavens, and we understand that to be the rainbow. Okay, and he says that's the sign of the covenant. There's covenants have different signs. If you think about the new covenant, there's the sign of the new covenant. If you have the Mosaic covenant, there's a sign of the Mosaic or a sign of the Abrahamic covenant. This is the sign of the covenant. Couple things right here. The Gilgamesh epic, once again going back to this. In the Gilgamesh epic, it mentions the goddess Ishtar, who wore a necklace, and they have this necklace. They've got this necklace. It was made out of lapis lazuli. That's a blue stone. And in the epic, she wore that, the goddess wore that necklace to remember the oath she had took to never forget the days of the flood. Is that not amazing? Ishtar wears a necklace to remind her of the days of the flood. And that is in this writing right here. And they've got that necklace, and it's made in the image. The little beads are carved into the image of little flies, which is just exactly how the gods came around the altar. It's just, you just keep stumbling over clues that make this connection. Not a clean connection, but someone's telling the same story, just getting the details mixed up. In this picture right here, this is the god Ashur, like you see the Assyrians, but that's the god Ashur, and he's in the heavens holding out his hand with, in the gesture of peace, holding his bow down in a non-threatening way, and that is the symbol of their god. God says, when I bring clouds over the earth, here's the clouds blowing in. Now, that could be a storm, just a typical rainstorm. It could be clouds, and there's ever a theophany, the clouds of God's presence blow in. Or this could refer to the dark clouds of judgment coming upon mankind for different sins that they would have to deal with. And there have been national disasters or judgments. But whenever I bring clouds, let's just say clouds, or you could read that, whenever I bring judgment, and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember, it will come to my mind, my covenant that is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, and the water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. I'll remember that. I'll act on that covenant. When the bow is in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant. Notice, everlasting covenant between God and every living creature. This covenant, we say it's between Noah, but he says here, between God, he says myself, and every living creature, I will not do that again. God said to Noah, here's the third time. Third time he says something here in these verses, like three speeches he's got here. This is the sign of the covenant that I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth. I will not flood the earth again. And like I said before, that is the end of the story of Noah and the flood. We pick up next week talking about what happens after that, which is the genealogy. I'll pray, and I appreciate you being here. Father, we do thank you for the chance to look into these things. We ask that we would, again, honor your promises, honor your will for our lives, that we would live not with third world thinking, but live with thoughts that are elevated, the wisdom that comes from the scriptures, and live in a way that would edify ourselves, our family, and our nation. And we ask that we, again, would be a blessing to the world because of your word and because of the life you've given to us at this time in history. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for being here.